really started. I'm Joe Atkins, and chairing this panel, which is looking at working class consciousness and the desire to raise that consciousness, addressing the need for raising that consciousness, both outside the labor movement and within the labor movement. And we're looking at that issue from a variety of perspectives. And in and of itself, you have to address the idea of middle class consciousness. It doesn't really work for the people who want to be middle class, to consider themselves middle class in this country, and how that notion itself has been co-opted and distorted in ways. Our guest today, to my right, Bob Fitch, who is a great organizer, author of Solidarity for Sale, and this summer, publication New Politics is going to have a colloquy on a series of articles he wrote about Charlie Brown, so that'll be interesting. You might want to look out for that. And to my left, Steve Early, a writer and organizer, strike strategist, labor educator, lawyer, and author of Vetted with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on Class Joy at Home. That's a great book, by the way. I am a professor at the University of Mississippi, a veteran journalist and columnist, and author of the book Coverage of Losses, Labor of the Southern Press, which was published in 2008. I think we're going to start out with Bob.
Thank you, Joe. Ladies, gentlemen, fellow academics, trade union brothers and sisters, analysts, it's a pleasure to participate in this discussion today. My topic is the labor left and union democracy. C. Wright Mills, in his book, The New Men of Power, observed that the independent labor left is generally pretty marginal, but in times of crisis, it can move from the margins to the center. We can form critical centers, centers of fresh analysis, centers for new directions and departures. In the fall of 2008, America elected its first black president. Global capitalism descended into its meltdown mode. Chicago workers seized the Republic windows and doors of Waterhouse to the applause of almost the entire country. Many of us believe that America was on the cusp of a historic leftward shift. We were correct about the shift, but wrong in the direction. Instead, it is the right in the form of the deeply reactionary Tea Party movement that seems to have all the momentum. We suspected that leaders wanted to return to the days before civil rights, but who would have guessed that they wanted to take us back to the days before the 17th Amendment and the direct election of senators? At the same time, organized labor seems weaker, more isolated, more on the defensive than at any time in modern history. Unfortunately, the evidence is everywhere. The collapse of its political agenda built around the Employee Free Choice Act, its standing in public polls, the record low private sector union density, the similarly unprecedented low level of strike activity, acutely documented recently by panelists really here. The specter of a Democratic president elected with hundreds of millions in cash from organized labor, publicly supporting the firing of unionized teachers in Rhode Island. And what's the response? Unlike some European countries where general strikes and boss snappings are commonplace, here our leadership fights with press releases, with paper resolutions, with threats to retaliate against anti-labor Democrats in the fall. The AFL-CIO president, Rich Trumka, assures us that EFCA is going to pass eventually. It's a leadership that recognizes only one strategy, no matter what the conditions are, and that is persisting in a war of position while the adversary adopts a war of maneuver. In other words, if you'll pardon the sports analogy, organized labor resembles the Ohio State football teams of the 1960s and 70s. whatever the situation, Coach Woody Hayes and the staff always called for the same play, which came out of the same playbook. 4 yards and a cloud of dust, again and again. The difference between Ohio State coaches and our play callers, Labor, is that for Ohio State, the strategy of consistency worked. Ohio State won a lot of games. For organized labor, its war of position strategy is not working. And it hasn't for more than a generation. In his famous lecture, Politics is a Vocation, Max Weber said the secret of politics was persistence, the slow boring of hard boards. But surely he didn't mean persisting in failure and boring everyone to death. If it's foolish to expect adaptive change from the labor establishment, is it possible for the labor left, as presently constituted, to be the change agent? Please pardon me if I express my doubts. Labor leftists are those who see organized labor not simply as a kind of forklift to raise wages and deliver them to specific groups of workers, but in terms of its potential for uniting the working class and transforming society. Ideally, they view their own involvement not simply as a source of livelihood, but as a vocation. Like mainstream labor, however, the labor left's playbook has a Woody Hayes-like consistency. And not much has changed in the way of basic analysis of labor's plight and what it needs to do since the days of Matt Shackman, the founder of the Trotskyist Workers' Party, an ideological mentor to many of America's most prominent labor leftists. One reason for the lack of novelty, I would submit, is that much of the labor left is under the spell of a dominant ideology. An ideology is a body of ideas that rearranges reality in order to justify a pattern of actions and political choices. A dominant ideology incorporates a smaller group and a larger group with different aims and values. It's not that the subordinate group is brainwashed by the dominant group. On the contrary, the subordinate group freely develops ideology. The point is to enjoy the benefits of subordination, often described as resources, without feeling the loss of autonomy or the betrayal of the original aims and values. The strategy of a dominant ideology is to strain at gnats while swallowing camels. The dominant ideology of the labor left is probably union democracy. Certainly not all labor leftists believe in the primacy of union democracy. The call for labor renewal in 2005 by prominent labor leftists, including Bill Fletcher Jr., hardly mentioned it. But union Democrats offered a clear sense of what organized labor must do to realize its potential. Rather than simply deplore the symptoms of decline, the inability to strike, organize, create a movement, or move a political program, they offer a structural analysis of labor's problems. Since labor leaders depend on the structure, the set of legal and political institutions on which their authority rests, such analysis risks antagonizing the leaders and reducing the possibility of gaining access to union resources. By contrast, union Democrats have the courage to dissent in a clientistic union culture whose highest value is loyalty, and where sanctions can result in a lifetime loss of livelihood. Such clarity and courage deserve the respect of criticism. Union democracy owes its origin to Max Shackman, the brilliant, charismatic, dissenting Trotskyist who co-founded the Workers' Party in 1940. He defined the field of left politics, where either in the Soviet Union or in American trade unions, as a struggle between democracy and bureaucracy. His use of this binary conformed to the fundamental requirement for ideological production, that is, that its defining terms be empty signifiers, empty in the sense that either they don't exist at all, or the term's meaning is so ambiguous as to justify almost any political course. Admittedly, Shackman himself seems like an improbable progenitor of left wing's ideology. Trotsky's one-time foreign affairs commissar wound up as the ally of the most inveterate business unionists, including those promoting the Vietnam War. By the mid-50s, he was defining the struggle for democracy as the battle for the allegiance of labor leaders rather than union members. But his political direction could be understood as the logical consequence of his premises. All labor leaders are bureaucrats, but some bureaucrats, totalitarian communists, are worse than others. And with the exception of the Soviet Union itself, no communists were more bureaucratically top-heavy and therefore more evil than the Communist Party of the United States. Therefore, union democracy consists in the struggle to align with the less evil bureaucrats against the most evil bureaucrats, the CPUSA. As Shachtman began to drift more and more to the right, he was opposed by two of his main disciples. The first was Hal Draper, who would later write influential but one-dimensional Two Souls of Socialism, and who also co-founded the Berkeley-based Independent Socialist Club, from which the Teamsters for a Democratic Union descended. The other was Herman Benson, Brooklyn-based founder of the Association for Union Democracy. They gave union democracy a less paradoxical slant, one more attuned to the values of the labor left. In Draper's model, two and only two vectors exist in the political universe, up and down. There's the democratic vector. It's made up of those on the bottom exerting pressure from below. And there's the bureaucratic, where the topmost issue orders from above. True labor leftists help the former and oppose the latter. Leftists, however, must operate with great care. First, they must make sure their opposition is loyal. That means, Draper said, loyal to the interests of trade unionism. Second, the true interests of trade unionism demand that there be only one union, not in the wobbly sense of one big union, but in the AFL-CIO sense of maintaining the system of traditional jurisdictional monopolies. So a split in a business union leading to two unions competing for the same jurisdiction is not, according to Draper, dual unionism. Any effort to create a union on alternative foundations, however, is dualism and therefore deplorable. Time and again, he explained, experience has shown that any kind of breaking of real new territory can most successfully be done outside the framework of an existing organization which has become fossilized, but not outside the trade union movement. Why AFL-CIO fossils should be an exception, Draper doesn't explain. According to Draper, any union that's created on the basis of, quote, some ideological aim about the nature of the trade union movement is bad, whereas a union trying to seize another's jurisdiction is okay. Draper accepts the seeming paradox that Rosa Luxemburg and the IWW deviated from labor principles, whereas the mob-run laundry workers' unions did not. Given Draper's definition of trade union interests, it's no surprise that he would later oppose the strategy of industrialization that emerged within his organization, permeating the AFL-CIO with rank-and-file struggle groups, the openly socialist precursors of what would become the non-socialist Teamsters for Democratic Union. Draper's best example to true fidelity to trade union principles was his wife's career as a middle-level official with the West Coast Army Union. Herman Benson, the former labor editor of the Shachtmanite Labor Action, did support TDU. It was only one of many labor reform groups he supported and advised since he founded the Association for Union Democracy in the mid-60s. Since then, he's become labor's outstanding civil libertarian. It's hard to think of anyone who's done more to defend workers' land-driven rights. Any regular reader of NUD's Union Democracy Review or Benson's blog will find no sharper or more knowledgeable criticism of union autocracy. That the academic leftists who organized the 1995 Columbia University Teaching with Labor could exclude them said more about their stature than his. Unfortunately, though, Benson sees politics and trade unionism in almost exactly the same term as Draper and Shachtman. For him, American politics exemplify the eternal conflict between bureaucracy and democracy. According to Benson, the labor movement is the great pillar of American democracy. But this great pillar of democracy, he observed, is nibbled away by the mice of bureaucracy. To paraphrase Emerson, bureaucracy is in the saddle and is riding mankind. The bureaucrats stifle the energies of the workers. They make them apathetic. It's the job of leftists to help the working class chase away the bureaucratic mice by making their unions more democratic. But what is democracy? Benson gets testy when forced to confront this question. It seems academic to him. What could it possibly mean other than plain old American democracy, the Bill of Rights as conceived of by the founders, or, as he puts it, democracy, democracy? More critical reflection might unravel a paradox that ought to concern Benson. Unions, like the Teamsters, have become a lot more democratic in the sense that he offers without being more democratic in a really substantive sense. Prior to Landon Griffin in 1959, elections weren't federally mandated. Many unions didn't have them or had them only rarely. Now at least there is what political scientists call minimal democracy. There are elections, there is competition between politicians for votes, but no sense that the workers are sovereign or that union regimes are democratic in the sense that Lincoln made famous, of, by, and for the people. The Teamsters have gone from mob domination to what may be America's most democratic union, at least in Landon Griffin terms. But since the inception of direct elections for national office in 1991 and federal election oversight, which brought down reformer Ron Kerry, fewer and fewer Teamsters participated then. In the last election, only about a quarter of the members bothered to vote even when provided with mail-in ballots. It seems as if the struggle for democracy produced a lot more political vitality than democracy itself. Apathy can't be explained, as Benson would have it, by the bureaucratic trampling of union civil liberties, because bureaucrats don't normally run unions. As anyone who's ever worked as a union bureaucrat will attest, they will do what they're told by elected officials. Andy Stern's rule over the SEIU has been seen by Benson and others as the triumph of centralism and bureaucracy. Stern created his own barons from his entourage, whom he set out to rule the provinces. But last month, Labor's would-be King John met his Runnymede. The baron said, "No mas." Stern's resignation and their refusal to ratify his chosen successor as president illustrates just how powerful the centrifugal forces working to empower the local baronies remain in the U.S. model of unionism. The king can make barons, but the barons get local fiefdoms to give them the potential to unmake the king. In our system, which features 25,000 semi-autonomous locals, the elected officers win office not because they have the support of the staff. It's actually the other way around. They have the support of the staff because they win elections. And they win elections because they built a political machine made up of patronage followers who exchange loyalty to the union boss for positions and perquisites. The machine can generally count on staying in power as long as it delivers a union premium and, in craft unions, keeps the out-of-work list short. Benson notwithstanding, political apathy is a natural product of this one-party machine culture and of the narrow restrictions on the political agenda created by local autonomy. These confine the workers to a low political horizon shaped by his local's contract and his own individual grievances. Just like district politics in the South Bronx or ward politics on the south side of Chicago, union micropolitics rarely offers workers the opportunity to consider, much less exercise leverage on wider supervening class issues. That the local union acts as a kind of political lunesta is bad. Worse, though, than the centrifugal forces isolating workers are those antagonistic forces created by the goal of the local union premium. The whole legal infrastructure based on exclusion, coercion, and exclusive bargaining is designed to enable local members to earn a wage higher than those doing the same work outside the local. Unsurprisingly, the local union member tends to see others in competitive terms, both the non-unionists undercutting his contractual wage, as well as other unionists seeking to take his work. Whereas the most basic aim of unionism is to unite workers by taking the wages out of competition. My first sense that there was something deeply wrong, not with just this or that labor leader, or even with their collective propensities, but with the foundations of American unionism, came on a picket line. It was being manned by a New York City local 608 carpenter, who I later got to know and work with on Hard Hat News, a rank and file paper. He was an Irish American very active in the carpenter's reform movement, who at the time was picketing the use of non-union labor in a Wall Street office to residential conversion. It was so common during the downturn of the early 90s. The workers on the job were Asian non-union carpenters. Patrick expressed no racial animosity. He simply insisted that the Asians were welcome to join the union, only though if they could persuade their contractor to become a union contractor. So the non-union workers faced a real catch-22. They were regarded as scabs because they were working non-union, but effectively, they weren't allowed to join the union either. This exclusionary feature of craft unionism goes back to the 19th century. John Stuart Mill criticized it, so did Engels. Union Democrats generally don't. The real democracy deficit in American labor unions is not that the locals are bureaucratic, it's that there are American-style locals at all. What's missing from the one-dimensional ideology of union democracy, imprisoned in the metaphors of bottoms and tops, is any sense of the scope of political conflict. The aim of the right is always to restrict the scope of class conflict, to bring it down to as low a level as possible. The smaller and more local the political unit, the easier it is to run it oligarchically. Frank Capra's picture in A Wonderful Life of Bedford Falls under the domination of Mr. Potter illustrates the way small union politics usually works. The aim of conservative urban politics is to create small towns in the big cities, the local patronage machines run by the Floyd Blakes and the Pedro Espadas. The genuine left, however, seeks exactly the opposite, not to democratize the machines from within, but to defeat them by extending the scope of conflict, breaking down local boundaries, nationalizing and even internationalizing class action and union representation. As political scientist E.E. Schechtschneider wrote a generation ago, the scope of labor conflict is close to the essence of the controversy. What were the battles about industrial and craft unionism, industry-wide bargaining, sympathy strikes, he asked, but efforts to determine, quote, who can get into the fight and who is excluded? The first step in the transformation of American unionism in the 21st century is to get beyond exclusion and coercion, accomplishing a task that in other countries was accomplished as early as the late 19th century. A labor left that breaks with the old playbook will bypass the old autonomous and local union. It will fight to end monopoly unionism, creating a system of representation that's based on genuine consent, offering workers a choice of political ends, transforming finally a culture that breeds sectionalism into one that promotes solidarity. Because what the labor left is not leads is not union democracy, but working class democracy. Thank you very much.
I want to mention Mark Fishgold, who was going to be with us, a veteran labor writer and former president of the International Labor Communications Association, who was unable to make it last minute. I think out of the order we've arranged, I'm going to speak next and we'll turn it over to Steve. We're going to, in my comments, move from questions of labor democracy or lack thereof within the labor movement to workers in general, both inside and outside of the movement. When we were first organizing this panel, one of the issues that came up was just the need for a national labor labor journal, a daily labor newspaper, a news product that could serve working class people in the country as a whole and help raise working class consciousness. And it's one of the oldest, it's an issue that's as old as the labor movement itself. And as I was putting together ideas for this, I went back to Upton Sinclair's novel in 1906, In the Jungle, to Jurgis Rutkus. And there's a passage in that novel that made me think of this issue. And I'll quote from Sinclair. And it's Rutkus thinking about newspapers in his life, and particularly the Sunday paper. One of these papers was as good as a circus, and nearly as good as a spree. Certainly a most wonderful treat for a working man. He was tired out and stupefied, he never had any education. His work was one dull, sordid grind, day after day, and year after year. The newspaper that Rutkus read, undoubtedly was one that was filled with crime and scandal, perhaps sex or what have you, and but one that was entertaining to him, full of feature stories and all kinds of different types of stories, but probably little that offered any kind of sort of opportunity to raise his own class consciousness or make him aware or educate him about the system that held him bound. And yet, such newspapers did exist in turning to Central Chicago. John Beckett, the media scholar, has written about this. Publications like The Workers' Call, Chicago Labor News, The New Majority, and so forth. The sad truth was, people like Jurgis Rutkus didn't read those papers. They read the mainstream capitalist papers of the time, and still do. The challenge to, as I said, to find a true media voice for the working class that enjoys widespread and enthusiastic support by the working class is as old as the labor movement itself, and perhaps that challenge is even greater to us today than it was Sinclair's life. So I'm going to proceed here with something of a quixotic venture and say that's what we need today is a national labor newspaper. Yes, at a time in which newspapers are folding left and right, which people are talking about the eventual disappearance of newspapers, and they're replaced by internet media and so forth. But let me sort of proceed and take on these challenges. I think what we really need is a kind of a modern 21st century version of PM, the legendary newspaper that was published in New York between 1940 and 1948. It was a publication that vowed to, quote, take a stand against the people who push other people around. That's certainly not something we have today, but something we need. That need has been addressed by many, not just by myself. In their 2008 manifesto for a left turn, author Stanley Aronowitz and his team of co-authors called for a radical project to reinvigorate the left of this country. And to do it, from starting on newsreading, hard copies of the internet is a high priority. More than a dozen years ago, Nation magazine had a cover story titled Why America Needs a Labor Daily. Now, I'll quote from that story by Scott Sherman. If stockbrokers, lawyers, and bankers have a first-rate daily newspaper, Wall Street Journal, looking after their interests, why isn't there one for auto workers, clerks, janitors, and the rest of us? That is to say, a national paper that covers crime in the suites as passionately as crime in the streets. A paper that revives the muckraking tradition of Upton Sinclair, Lincoln Steffens, and Ida Tarbell. You know, look back historically, however, Steffens and Tarbell wrote for magazines. They didn't write for newspapers. They wrote for McClure's, Cosmopolitan, and so forth. They got the seeds of their stories off from the daily newspapers of the day, but they wrote for magazines. We do have muckraking magazines still with us today. We have Nation magazine, Mother Jones in these times, Progressive Populist, Labor News, others as well. We have online journals that are doing good investigative reporting, the small staffs, but journals such as Facing South by the North Carolina-based Institute for Southern Studies. We don't really have a major U.S. newspaper service function. There are some newspapers. I was just in the panel previously to talk about the Charleston Gazette in West Virginia, really doing a good job in the mainstream media covering working people. But we don't have it on a national level. Nothing like what you can find in some other countries. La Jornada, Mexico, Il Manifesto, in Italy, for example. And yet, that's what we need. Sherman is an article from back in 1997, explains why we need, and I'll add to this with an explanation as well, why we need a daily newspaper rather than a magazine or a weekly or simply an internet site. With a newspaper, you reach an audience that you don't get with these other media. Blue-collar workers or people. This was once again also discussed in the previous panels, and still read newspapers. Much more likely to be found in a newspaper than with a computer checking out the internet sites, even today. There's still the permanence of print that has a certain quality that other media don't. Print scares politicians because of that permanence. And even media sites today, internet sites, they still depend on newspapers for much of the reporting, much of the facts. How would you finance such an operation? I'm not going to offer any past solutions to this. Too bad. It'd be nice if we found a Marshall Field II, such as what PM had, a major financier to back such a publication. And George Soros, perhaps. I'm not sure. Maybe a better idea would be an employee-owned newspaper or some such. There are examples of that in other countries. Of course, the discussion today has to include multimedia, media cross platforms, and the internet. And I think that any major labor publication would have to include the internet version as well. And but however difficult the challenge may be, the need is there. William Serum, a veteran writer, had this to say in a recent essay. He says, today is an epic time for good journalism. It's much like the 1930s in many ways, when workers and the writers and artists who articulated their hopes and aspirations rose against the greatest odds. Quoting from Sarah, workers are losing their jobs, families are being decimated, working class communities are in shambles. And then there's all the international stuff. In journalistic vocabulary, this is a great story, but it's not being covered. Working class people are struggling, and I'm probably speaking to people I don't have to convince of that, but I will give you a few statistics. Household income declined between 2000 and 2007. Talk about immediately up to the recent recession, during which time the wealthiest of Americans enjoyed a 50% increase in their income, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average was 64%. Adjusted for inflation, the average worker's wages dropped 29% between 1973 and 2008, while CEO salaries jumped from 45 times that of the average worker to more than 300 times. As I said once again in the previous panel, I think the corporate model of the media or newspaper ownership has been disastrous. Between 1998 and 2008, newspaper circulation in the United States dropped 27%. Less than 50% of Americans today actually read newspapers on a daily basis. But it didn't have to be that way. And it's not everywhere like that. Look at Germany. Roughly 3 out of 4 Germans still read newspapers on a daily basis. Newspaper revenues have remained stable for the past 6 years as a whole. Newspapers in Germany, however, by and large, are owned by families and small companies, not by publicly owned corporations. But even before the decline in newspapers in recent years, the working class was not getting a fair shake in the newspapers in earlier, better times. William Derasiewicz wrote about this in a publication for the American Scholar, in which he said, the working class in American culture is American culture's great lost continent. The obsession with attaining a middle-class lifestyle, fueled in part by union successes in the 1930s, actually suited the aims of the elite creating the illusion that this is a classless society. Derisiewicz goes on to address the issue of race. The only issue that was allowed to disturb this illusion, which he says, just about the only images we have of the working class are images of black people, understood as black people, not as working class people. It's an old American story. Race becomes a surrogate for class, which is to say, a way of not thinking about it at all. And he cites the coverage of Hurricane Katrina as an example in which we were beginning to think about class, and we first saw the first images of that story unfold, but then it sort of evolved into a discussion other than class, race. One reason he cites for this disappearance of the working class from our media are the people who tell the stories. The people who get paid to create mainstream culture are journalists, editors, writers, producers, are members of the middle class. However, I think this is changing. An estimated 14,000 media jobs disappeared in 2009. A fifth of the newspaper jobs that existed in 2001 were gone by the end of 2009. I'm going to quote from one of the best blogs out there from the Center for Working Class Studies, Working Class Perspectives. Quote Connie Schultz, columnist at Cleveland Frank Plain Beamer. Most of us have a lot more in common these days with the people we cover. I see that as an opportunity for journalists once again to identify with working class people, as they once did. There are many great efforts going on out there to have a true working class news product. I mentioned the Center for Working Class Studies. Also, the Institute for Social Studies, Facing the South, the blog is absolutely wonderful as far as really investigative reporting. They're doing a project right now on coal ash and its effects on our environment. And so there are many efforts out there. However, the need is still there for a major national voice for the voiceless. One that was called for by George Sells, A.J. Lee, one of my heroes in journalism. It would have to be a fusion of old and new media with an online edition as well as blogs, combined by art, music, and video, appeal to young workers as well as to older ones, be entertaining, be thrilling. In other words, the kind of newspaper Jurgis Rutkus would read, but one that also reminded him every day that he was somebody valuable with a place in society, and all the rights that belong to him as a human being.
We've got a lot of experienced activists here, people who like to talk, people who have a lot of strong opinions of their own, so I'm going to keep this very short, so we have as close to 45 minutes as possible to use the rest of our time together for discussion. I want to get back to one of the things that we wanted to talk about in this panel related to the discussion in the whole conference about how unions should relate better to the broader working class. It seems to me one of the key challenges at the moment facing all of our unions, one that I was active in for many years, CWA, UAW, which is represented here, other unions, at the moment is how do we position ourselves as defenders of all workers, not just our existing and dwindling band of current dues-paying members. And this, you know, is really a challenge that's kind of reaching crisis proportions, particularly for public employee unions. Every day we see what's left of unions in this country depicted as greedy islands of privilege. It's an image that's widely propagated in the media. It's exploited by the employers. I mean, we're in the middle of a huge concession bargaining wave. Public employees are giving away benefits left and right. They're agreeing to furloughs, they're agreeing to pay freezes, yet they're still getting whacked. And there's kind of growing begrudgery in the land, particularly private sector workers who've been laid off, never had a decent pension plan, whose unemployment is running out, their taxes are going up. They're being whipped up as a force to be pitted against the privilege. In this case, now a slight majority of all union members employed in the private sector. My own hometown of Boston, the city council, one of the union strongholds of America, is in its second day of rancorous debate today about whether or not to overturn an arbitrator's wage award for the firefighters who've been 4 or 5 years without a contract. You know, if this is a wage increase that could be funded by maybe an hour or two of the cost of the war in Afghanistan, but no, we're not in the streets about that. We're, about to vote, I think, in the city council not to implement this arbitration settlement of the contract dispute, because even a group that generally is popular in the public sector as firefighters is being demonized as greedy, as overpaid, as budget busting, union guys that have got to settle for concessions too. So I think there's an incredible challenge right now for people who are still in active trade union roles, and I've been kind of redeployed from that after 27 years as a negotiator and organizer and a rep for CWA, who are still involved in bargaining, still trying to find ways to resist healthcare cost shifting at the bargaining table, to kind of universalize our demands and find a way to link resistance to concessions demanded by employers to broader demands, particularly in the area of healthcare. And over the years, my own union in this region did quite a bit about that. We had a big strike nearly 20 years ago at 9X. It was all about who was going to pay what for medical benefits. Our demand was healthcare for all, not healthcare cuts at 9X, because we understood that telecom workers then and now are relatively privileged in the area of their health coverage. Brother here is a Verizon worker. That contract's up next year as a result of that. 4 month strike 20 years ago by 60,000 workers, an incredible struggle. To this day, Verizon workers and their families pay nothing for their premiums, right? That's down to like 5% of the working population, something that the company is going to be reminding Verizon workers of next year when they, for the umpteenth time, after many strikes and contract campaign solutions over the years, come at that arrangement once again. So, whether it is framing our issues the way the Teamsters did in 1997 when they made themselves champions against, the part-time work trend while fighting that issue out within UPS, or as CWA and other unions have tried to do over the years when faced with demands for healthcare cost shifting, they have tried to frame the issue as not just, hands off our benefits, our better than average medical plan. But no, we're going to resist this because there is no solution to the problem of medical cost inflation at any one bargaining table. We have to have national health insurance and so forth. This, challenge, which, we should maybe talk a little bit about because it probably affects a lot of people here, is not one that the labor movement in the last year or two has met very well. In fact, we've moved in the opposite direction in the context of labor's campaign for healthcare reform. Unions ended up being boxed in on the defensive and looking very badly, in my view, as a result of the majority tendency reflected by AFSCME, SEIU, even CWA. Their Healthcare for America Now coalition kind of going with the Obama program of not really fighting to expand social insurance, trying to patch up the existing job-based private insurance system. In the process of being too complicit with that strategy, union members who were told in 2008, vote for Obama, not for McCain, very often around this issue of taxation of benefits, discovered a year later that the guy they elected, knocked on doors for, made phone calls for, contributed money to, wanted to tax their benefits. And I think if you look at the history of this campaign, and I did a long article for it, it's coming out for Working USA in a couple of months, and I won't get into it all, but the so-called Cadillac benefits tax, the luxury insurance tax, that excise tax that emerged from the Senate a year ago and then was embraced by Obama, really was a kind of poison pill for the labor movement. As I know in my own union, the major focus of our healthcare reform mobilization a year ago, all the mailings, all the appeals, all the mobilization activity was all around don't tax our benefits, right? But suddenly, you know, we were no longer campaigning for single payer, for national health insurance, for healthcare for all. We were fending off an attack, not from the Republicans, but from the Democrats on the better than average union negotiated health plans. And, you know, even though there were a series of compromises and finally at the White House in January of this year, kind of a negotiated agreement postponing the implementation of this Cadillac benefits tax. Again, the framing, you know, something we always thought was the Chevy suddenly becomes a Cadillac. And the solution to the healthcare crisis, you know, how we fund coverage for the uninsured, how we restrain medical cost inflation, is to tax the people and the employers who, under duress, in the case of firms like Verizon, have provided these better than average benefits. And I would just say that, you know, this is an example of how the pragmatism of the labor movement becomes at some point crackpot realism and is incredibly counterproductive. Because, you know, one of the reasons, for what it's worth, I just would think not much, the Democrats don't have 60 votes in the Senate at this point is because of what happened in Massachusetts on January 27th, you know, when Ted Kennedy's seat was lost to a fellow named Scott Brown, who basically campaigned as the guy who's not going to tax your benefits. Whereas the Democrat was going to run down to Washington, be the 60th vote for Obamacare. And, you know, let me tell you, a lot of members of my old union and other unions, as the post-election poll showed, voted for the guy who was not going to tax their benefits, because that had been the major focus of all the union agitation for the previous 4, 5, 6 months. So, you know, my hat's off to the folks in the single payer movement. They put up a great fight last year trying to frame this issue properly, trying to get unions to remember that they're always going to be vulnerable unless they position themselves as the defenders of the broader working class. I think this recent lesson is a very major dope slap in that regard. So, with that, I would throw it open for discussion.
When is the financial paper coming out?
Still
working on that. Now, I wonder though what, you know, what it would take to bring something out, because it would be a godsend, excuse the phrase. It would be really a great benefit. I have something like USA Today, but the real USA.
In Sherman's article in The Nation, he estimated at that time, this was 1997, it cost $300 million to do it, on what it would cost today. And it would have, you know, I stress this enough, it would be one that would have to be independent of the labor establishment as well as of Wall Street. The way I envision it, open to advertising from what you use, what have you, but not be dependent upon that. So,
I have another alternative. I've wrestled with this question for a long time. I mean, some of you may know I was on staff at Guardian for a long time, studied the economics of Carl Davidson, and studied the economics of newspapers of all sorts, including from the left. So I came to the conclusion that all newspapers are ad businesses, hobbies of rich people, or charities. Usually some combination of the three. regardless of political content, to survive, the break-even point for the Guardian was 200, quarter of a million publications, a quarter of a million circulation in order to break through on subscriptions alone. So we were nowhere near that, and no publication in the country is anywhere near that. So that means you have to sell ads. Otherwise, or you have to have a rich person whose publication is your hobby.
I think PM started out without the ads and eventually had to.
But it started out as a hobby of a rich person.
In the 60s, I was with Rampart's Magazine. Yes. And we had a novelist manager who used to steal from the rich people who were
But I think the alternative, which is, and it's a lot less than $300 million, which is a few years back, the LA Weekly was up for sale. The LA Weekly has a circulation of 120,000 in LA, and it won for $6 million. The Foucon ad sellers didn't give a damn what its political content was, and the LA Weekly's political content was relatively left and progressive. Those papers exist in every major city in the country, and there's no reason why they couldn't be bought for probably $100 million. You could probably buy all of them. And the point is that the money wouldn't just go down in two, because the LA Weekly is basically a money maker. Whoever bought it for $6 million got their money back very quickly, plus provided a number of people with a living. Even though you passed the paper out free, watch people read the ads to determine which clubs they go to and which Foucons they buy, and that's why you get the paper for free after you read the ads. So that's a cheaper way to do it. And then you would have a centralized labor news service to supply content to all of them. You can build a network of them. So that's the only practical way, I think, of doing what you're talking about. We buy up these money makers on the metropolitan basis as ad businesses, which is what they are, and provide labor content to. But the trade union movement has that kind of money, and it's a matter of convincing them that it's better spent there than in some of the political campaigns that they do.
That's what I want to do.
Well, just on that, I happen to know somebody who set out to do that. I mean, she started from the bottom up, started a chain of those newspapers that ended up being bought out slash pushed out of this chain. I think most of those papers are now by chains. They are profit-making.
Yes, they make a lot of money.
But actually, what I wanted to ask about is, there's an obvious tension here between Steve and Bob's presentation of things, where Steve says, "Oh, isn't it terrible that the labor movement looks like, islands of greedy islands of privilege?" And Bob is saying, "The labor movement is greedy." And I just wondered, since one of the things I'm looking forward to your talk at the end of your book was the positive proposal.
Yeah, well, we can talk about both things. We can talk about the proposal, and we can deal with the issue of our Steve's perspective and my perspective that different. I would say they're complementary. The way I interpret Steve is that the union movement has gotten itself in a bind by appearing to be a labor aristocracy. And his analysis of the healthcare debate, I think, is spot on. I would just say that the labor movement is not exclusively an agency of labor aristocracy, but there is a core there, probably the core that I'm most familiar with, that worked in craft unions, that is structured to produce labor aristocracy, so that it's not really a question of framing its perspective in a way that will be more accommodative. It's a matter of complete structural reform. It's a matter of transcending a 19th century business unionism that's focused around what Selig Perlman called the job territory. He was a big defender of business unionism, and he pointed out this distinction between the European and American unions, that the American union guy is not class conscious, he's job conscious, and he and his mates want to defend this job territory. And so they look at other workers as adversaries and so forth. I think that this really hasn't changed a lot in 100 years, but that is the task of the labor left to change it. And that we should be about creating, as I suggested, the dual unions, which are not based on coercion, which are based on workers' consent, which don't exclude workers, and which have as their aim not democracy but socialism, which would see democratic unionism as a means towards enabling the socialist left to have an opportunity to present its case for socialism to working people, and would see democracy as a means and not an end. And look at the tacit left unionists as solidaristic in a sense that we can talk about the perhaps bigger decision.
Well, we've got a lot of people here. I try to use the example of conflict about healthcare because I think that's one area where at least one wing of the labor left, or actually the bulk of the labor left, because that's really what's been behind the single payer movement within unions, has tried to raise consciousness, do political education, get people, if not to embrace socialism, embrace the idea of social insurance, right? A step in a better direction than the job-based private welfare state that's collapsing in the auto industry and the telephone industry and other places. But people don't move from a position of, being attached to the status quo if over time it's working fairly well for them, to embracing radical new ideas without, in my experience, the experience of struggle and what has changed the consciousness of at least some IBW and CWA members in the Northeast over the years about national health insurance as opposed to having their benefits provided by an employment horizon was the experience of going through strikes over who's going to pay what about health care, having their health benefits cut off during strikes, and starting to make common cause with the groups that are less well off in the area of health care, which is a different approach from the old craft union, let's just negotiate improvements in our health and welfare fund and screw everybody else. I mean, over time, even some of the more privileged union represented groups have broadened their horizons a little bit, but it's not through kind of book reading and moral appeals, it's through what the companies have tried to take away from them, how some unions have framed and organized fights against that and tried to make that a kind of learning experience and get people involved in broader political coalitions for social and legislative solutions that traditional craft unions would not embrace.
Yes, Steve, I couldn't agree with you more. If anyone, I'm from Detroit, and if anyone followed and participated in a 5-year newspaper strike and watched what happened to everybody, whether they were rehired or not, still to this day, they are the stalwarts on picket lines for single payer, for labor against the war, and that they were radicalized forever because they were in struggle. And they were in what was craft unions, a divided workforce, and that struggle united them. Bob, I'm a little bit confused. Perhaps you compress what you have to say a little bit too much. I'm following, of course, the business union and Sally Perlman and Paul. And we seem to have missed in this, all of this discussion, the fact that on one level was rejected by mainstream American labor, in the middle of the 20th century. And we can't keep coming back and saying we have an aristocracy of labor in the building trades, because that's not really the issue anymore. The issue tends to be what has happened to our industrial unions, and what has happened to the left in the industrial unions, which in large part, while I would love to say the labor left, I don't know where you're going to find that mechanism, because it is a different period from being driven out time after time or losing strikes time after time. That there isn't a big labor left out there that merely needs to stand up and people will follow. I'm also concerned with your idea of what constitutes bureaucracy. and I'm sure Hal Draper would be very happy, perhaps even Matt Chapman, that you view them as the last word in political philosophy, in labor philosophy. But I am concerned that we are not talking about the left anymore. And what constitutes a bureaucrat? That is, if a rank and file movement in a local, say a UAW local or a CWA local or any local, manages to excite and energize its membership and get its slate elected, are they bureaucrats? I mean, they are in charge. They have a contract that they implement. They're not out leading the struggle against themselves. But what do you have to say for what happens when people on a progressive level actually take control of their local unions? And it seems to me that you're suddenly calling them bureaucrats too.
Yeah, well, obviously 15 minutes is not enough to convey a lot of these terms in their roundedness. You raised the issue of bureaucracy and the craft unionism. And let me deal first with the idea of craft unionism, something that doesn't exist anymore, was defeated early in the 20th century. And then we'll talk about the bureaucracy in relation to politics. I think that, you know, the essence of craft unionism is this selling Perlman idea of business unionism. And what we're talking about really is a kind of segmented consciousness where you're concerned just with the territory. And the particular craft basis of it, I think, intensifies the conservatism and the narrowness and hostility. But I think it's not the case that the 1930s, the kind of unions that developed the CIO, completely transcended business unions. I think that, pardon me?
Just a little bit, not completely.
Well, I think that you did retain the idea of the job territory. You did retain the local consciousness and the developed local autonomy, which you can see in the UAW as locals will become more and more autonomous over time. And management would exploit that in order to play off one local against the other. There would be concessions with one so that they could maintain more workforce than the other guy by providing more productivity. And I think that as a consequence of this failure, even in the CIO, we really can't set business unionism. American unionism has been dominated by the more conservative forces, and that the point is to understand the structural basis of those forces in a unique constellation of features that exist practically only in America, maybe New Zealand to some extent, Canada, and that is, these are features which are shared by CIO unions and AFL unions, and that is exclusive bargaining, union security, automatic dues checkoff. These features distinguish us from the labor movements of the rest of the world and put us in violation of International Labor Organization protocols on freedom of association, and tremendously limit the autonomy and power of the American working class as a whole. Now, my point about bureaucracy is that the analysis of unions in terms of bureaucracy as a major impediment to development abstracts from the kinds of features that we just mentioned and makes it seem as if the union is not, the union leadership is not based on a political machine, but is based on a staff that has skills. It completely ignores the sources of domination that exist in the union as such, and doesn't provide for a way of dealing with those structural problems which are keeping the American labor movement as the most retarded in the advanced industrialized world. So I think it is important to understand the problems of this false binary of the union democracy ideology and bureaucracy and a very limited kind of democracy.
I'm just curious here in this conversation, it gives me some thoughts, particularly hearing the last comment of Carl here, saying that what it will take to get your vision realized is to have the unions recognize the necessity that they need to devote resources to developing something like a daily. And as a member of a union or a chapter in a union that pays, by my calculations, close to $800,000 or $1 million a year in dues and gets back about $15,000 a year for its local chapter, which has been a point of great frustration. And seeing our leadership constantly support, donate, invest its energies in courting the Democratic Party, which does nothing that other than beat up higher education and labor in the state of Illinois. I guess I'm just curious for those who are involved in unions, and even Steve, your experience, because it sounds like you guys were communicating with each other, at least in terms of defeating the Cadillac healthcare bill. But what are the prospects for taking on our unions, so to speak, and getting them in ways the first speaker were talking about, starting to be more imaginative to engage in this? And I'd just be curious to see what people see as, because it's given me new ideas for sort of interacting with my union. In my chapter and in our local, to think about the devotion of resources and doing some different behavior, but I'm curious what you see as the prospects, if anyone has thoughts on that. Carl, if you have thought, you didn't seem very hopeful about it. But.
Well, I don't know about buying newspapers, but I think one thing that has to be taken into account, or at least ought to be discussed, is I think there's some important changes at the top. Leo Szilard is not the steelworkers president that I remember from 20, 30 years ago. And he is willing to spend some money and do things differently, radically differently, than many other people have done, and many other union leaders have done in the past or even at present. And he represents, I think, a trend, but I think Trump also to a certain extent. I think what these guys understand is that they have never been richer and never been weaker at the same time. And that if they don't do something, they're over. And so they are looking for allies in new ways. That's the meaning of the Blue-Green Alliance, their willingness to make a bargain in a relationship with the Sierra Club and then hundreds of others of these young environmentalist organizations, has to do with their whole youth initiative, has to do with the arrangement that Gerard has made with the Mondragon cooperatives to try to create a spring of worker-owned cooperatives in the Rust Belt, generate jobs or lean manufacturing, to call for the modern-day equivalent of the Tobin tax on Wall Street to fund green industrial policy and manufacturing. These are all new. And recent. So it's not by newspapers, but there's a lot of new openings that are happening within a certain sector of trade union leadership, and I think it's very important to acknowledge it and try to make the most of it.
I see that down the deep south, too, with the Unite Here, UAW, and so forth, looking for new ideas and new ways to develop down here, but also.
I mean, I think the brother's question about the spending priorities is still a very big problem. And these folks in positions of power within unions, controlling purse strings, don't feel enough pressure from below to develop new priorities. One very persistent forerunner of a print labor communications vehicle is Workers Independent News. I don't know if people subscribe to that. Frank Emspach's project based in Madison, Wisconsin, developed over the last 5, 6, 7 years. A lot of local unions subscribe to it. It has very good content. He's been able to get it out into some major AM stations in some major cities, but it is a struggle to keep this thing afloat, to raise $200,000 or $300,000 a year, which is a fraction of what you would need for more expensive medium of print, even with the internet. And every election cycle, Workers Independent News almost goes under because nobody has any money for Frank's project, which should be everybody's project in the labor movement, because everybody can use it for their own advantage. The spending is all going on, issue-oriented advertising or contributions to political parties or candidates. And if a small fraction of that kind of political spending was put into building a few of these institutions, then you'd certainly need a much larger scale investment to do a Workers Independent News newspaper project. We'd be on the road and have more models and have more examples and maybe getting the word out in ways that's not possible to do right now through the trends in corporate dominance.
In the last session I was in, it seemed like the main theme that ran through people's presentations was in talking about what neoliberalism has done, and that that part of the culture has basically become, and they kind of accepted language to some degree, that there is no alternative, which is the idea that is being sold to us full force. And when the union movement buys into that and they're kissing up to the Dems, which is really what they've been doing, it doesn't move anyone anywhere. It doesn't help the labor movement. It doesn't help the working class. And it separates the labor movement from the working class. As a grassroots organizer, I can tell you people want change. And a lot of people that did vote for Obama, even if they did it reluctantly, but hoping for some change, are extremely, feeling very disenfranchised. I mean, even people that are not in the unions. So when you're talking about things about unions making the issue, don't tax our benefits, while the rest of the working class is being sold down the river, and that's not being addressed. It seems to me that we're missing a point here. When people are saying there's no alternative, there has to be an alternative. The union movement needs a new vision, as Glaucer was saying, and it's that vision that needs to be developed and put out there. Something like and that's really what happened in the 20s and 30s. Research that I've been doing of developing this new vision and these networks that really motivated people and brought about a social justice movement and also brought about the New Deal. And it seems to me that's what the new movement needs to be concentrated on.
I should start by saying I'm new to the U.S. I came from Canada, so I'm still trying to feel my way around. But to make this movement, this new initiative, I think one of the differences between the 20s and 30s is you had a decent-sized base in the working class of largely European immigrants who identified with being part of the working class, who identified with some form of socialism. It had some sort of alternative vision. I don't think that bloc exists anymore in the U.S.,
That was only true in the 20s. The 20s was the major issue.
Was the
which? It was like the time when the union movement was the least in the 20s. But there was a lot of building going on in various different places with different networks building the social system.
So what I'm saying is from the 19th century up until, I guess, the Second World War, is you had a block, a percentage of strata in the world that had this alternative vision that gave their rise to build this type of unionism. I don't think that exists anymore. A lot of them were deported, the farmer raised, and a lot of them died out, and all this type of thing. And I noticed, I've worked with unions in West Virginia, and you'd be hard pressed to even hear the term working class. Because, I mean, I cringe when they keep talking about building the middle class, and I want to hit my head against the wall and say no. I mean, you can't get the word working class. Socialism is demonized. It's like using the word Satan. Any sort of sense, and maybe I sound like, maybe I'm over exaggerating coming from a different environment. This is the way it seems to me. You're right. Even the word left is hard to use. There doesn't seem to be a sense of a right and a left. As well as the kind of individualism and things that were pointed out by the panel, this idea of unions, business unions, as being an exclusive club to get members more things and viewing other people as interlopers, I still get a sense that's there. So how do you rebuild, and as people, the majority of people in the U.S. look at unions, not just the way they made it in the 30s, as weapons to fight for working people. They look at it as just another exclusive club. People don't identify with being in the working class, so, you know, at the risk of sounding, I don't know what word to use, but how do you start? You don't even have that base to start working, where you might just say, hey, I don't even know how to start this conversation with you.
Well, I think that we might, I agree with a lot of the factual picture that you present, with one exception. And that is that if you look at the results of a pretty recent Rasmussen poll, you see that despite the left lack of concern with socialism, the number of people who prefer capitalism to socialism is not much higher than you would think. And among people under 30, it's practically even. And I checked that out in a bunch of my classes. We did the polls, and socialism had an amazing, what is socialism? It's people being nice to each other. But they had a very check with the results of this right-wing Rasmussen poll. And my sense is that people have automatically gravitated towards an ideological alternative that enabled them to resist capitalist offenses. But that the labor movement has been kind of scorched earth territory for collectivist ideas, for ideals about solidarity, as just not being practical. But I think that we see now, and I think Steve pointed this out, that when we come into a crisis, the practical people, the people who had all these benefits in the union premium, really come under tremendous scrutiny. It's like what de Tocqueville said about the French aristocracy, that people hated them because they still had their money, but they didn't have their power. And I think that's what happened to the mainline business units, is that they've lost all their power and all they have their salaries, and people have kind of contempt for them. But I think just to put it on a positive level, that there is sympathy for alternative capitalism, even socialism. And it's the job of the left, I think, to do the pioneering work that was done in the late 20s and early 30s by communists and socialists to create alternative forms of unionism, which did become the basis for the new CIO and the new forms of advance. Only this time, I think we have to be much more conscious about the legal foundations of American unionism and the way that it's an outlier for the unionism of the entire advanced specialized world and progressive countries like Brazil that have alternative forms of unionism. And consciously try to create a kind of solidarity unionism which focuses neither strictly on self-interest nor on altruism, but tries to find common ground within the working class as a whole and creates unions who have a scope that makes that kind of concentration possible.
Well, let me have a quick, we've got a question over here, but that's part of what I was trying to say here. You know, you've got to regain some control of the message. That's what's been the problem. That's why the workers you've talked to have no sense of themselves as being part of the working class. They're still aspiring to this notion of middle class because of the corporate control of the message.
The question of it's really intriguing. I'm always very amused about the middle class and I listened to CNN like my religion, and I was listening to Lou Dobbs, CNN has lost, so I miss him. He was always talking about the middle class in America while he was talking basically about the working class, that the term working class has been taken out of the discourse. But my problem is slightly different, you know. I come from India, I was born out there, I read the history of colonialism, I was reading Marx and the consequences of the British rule in India. You remember Marx had said that working class in England will liberate itself and then liberate the colonies. What happened that Indians were able to liberate themselves irrespective of the British, they could not liberate the British working class. And you know, working class in no country actually supported the anti-colonial struggles. You know the frustration Mr. Fanon had with the working class in France and again and again. What has happened here, if you look back into the history, how has working class identified itself with the interest of the aristocracy and bourgeoisie against the working class of the third world? And now what's happening in the process of, and this is a long story, I'm cutting it short, is the revenge of the working class against the working class. Now jobs are going offshore, and the working class, which redefined, working class in America, which redefined itself as middle class and no more working class. Maybe it is a self-fulfilling prophecy that the working class is being liquidated as a result of the working class outside America, outside the first world, is going to the working class. And until and unless we change this vision, create some kind of global working class, workers of the world unite, fight against colonialism, redefine those issues which have been put on the back burner, the kind of sociology we are doing, the kind of anthropology we are doing, the economics we are doing, bring the world class in, try to understand the larger historical project which class struggle had. And until and unless there is something of that kind of historical, deeper social understanding of class, union, all that, where race, nationality, gender, all these divisions, so how can class overcome that? I think we will still be groping in the dark, you know, threatening local issues, getting local benefits, feeling happy about it, and dancing to the tune of the middle class. If they didn't exist, will not exist, it's withering away.
It's just so that you talk about Bill and then sorry.
I don't have the same academic background as everyone in the room. I've spent the last 40 years as a member of the CWA and the Typographers Union and the UAW. But one of the things that's clear to me is that one of the problems that we face is that there's not much left in the unions for this discussion to be centered around. And that's the problem, because how we regain working class consciousness within the labor movement isn't going to take place absent involvement of the left in that struggle. And we're looking at a changed playing field. Clearly, a lot of the changes that the employers have gone through in the last 20 or 30 years, you know, the development of lean manufacturing, the implementation of clear strategies for union busting or for co-opting and weakening the unions, is completely designed to minimize the power of the unions. So I don't think the problem in the UAW, for example, is that there's a growing autonomy of locals. The contracts that have been negotiated since the early 80s, quite the contrary, have centralized power out of the hands of the locals, away from the hands of the rank and file, and into the hands of an appointed army. It's appointed by the international leadership over the heads of the local union leaderships that are elected by the membership. So the problems, the actual problems that we're facing, for example, we had a big fight within the union over the 2007 national contract, where the attempt to oppose the contract on the part of the National Bargaining Committee was defeated by this army of appointed reps controlled by the International Union. I think it's a I would be the last one to say that the unions are automatically a form of struggle that working class struggle is going to take. Because I don't see that necessarily being the case. But I would say that they are the institution that exists today, and therefore the role of leftists is to fight for power within those institutions, to abstain from that, or to say it's more important to seek alternate institutions than to challenge the power within the working class institutions that exist, is to absent yourself from the struggle. That means then that when you win, then you have the problem of what do you do? How do you lead? And that gets to the question that I was hoping to gain some insight from this panel, and that is that after 40 years as a trade unionist, I feel like I'm on my way out without leaving people behind who are continuing on that struggle. They may cheer me on, elect me to office, support me in opposing the contract, but I haven't succeeded in training a new generation of workers to look at things strategically and politically, and that's a failure of the left.
I think we're just about out of time.
It's just a view from the United Kingdom. With Reaganism and Thatcherism, trade unions became to a situation where the trade union organisation became the central thing that was defended. The union was protecting the organisation, rather than looking after the membership of society, or colleagues, they said. They were richer than they'd ever been, but they were very, very weak. Just interesting enough, the last couple of years in the UK, we've seen unions being dragged by the membership into disputes. I don't know whether you were in the British Airways dispute. That the Unite Union is given as the leader of it's the branch within British Airways, the local. What do you call them? The local in British Airways that's forcing that strike. It's not the union. The union's been trapped behind it. We've also had, first time for a generation in England, wildcat strikes where people just walk off. In despite of the law, they just walk off. And unions have had to follow on. So the tide seems to be a chinks of life in the UK around working class consciousness, the willingness to take action, despite the trade union.
Little chains of light, man. I'm on those in the records.